The agent's black mistress stood there, two mulatto guards behind her, turning most of them away. She met us with a tight-lipped scowl, but our skins were white. She had to let us in. Inside the high brick wall, we found something close to panic. A mulatto in uniform was trying to drill a few black volunteers the agent had enlisted. A gun crew was loading the brass cannon on the roof. The agent was pale and sweating, shrilling, jittery commands. He shouted an order I didn't understand, and the guards hustled me into a concrete cell. I was there for several days, the worst I had ever known, without much hope of anything better. Alone, I had no contact with anybody who wanted to talk. I longed for news of Lupe and Derek and Ram and felt sick with fear for them. All three lost amid hazards. I couldn't imagine, perhaps no longer alive. With none of Derek's quiet detachment or Ram's ready competence, I found few resources of my own. The cell had only a bare concrete shelf for a bed and a foul hole in the floor for a toilet. The food was tough and tasteless little slabs of something I didn't recognize. I paced the narrow floor for exercise and spent hours staring at quick little lizards that darted up the walls. I had one brief break when my jailers let the traitor and his family visit. Hake was limping on a crutch, his head covered with a bandage that hid one eye. His wife looked ill and exhausted. Kenlith hugged me silently, his little body quivering with sobs. The guards stood watching from the door, as if ready for some attempt to set me free. I asked for news of Ram, news of anything.
"Nothing?" Lilalu's voice quivered and broke. "Nothing good. The wild blacks were crazy, stoned on raw Korath. They took everything we had, burned us down, ruined us."
"We are down." A long red scar ran down the traitor's cheek, but he tried to smile at her. "I've been down before. I'll get us up again."
"They were about..." Lilalu shivered and shrank from the guards. "About to chop his head off, till Toron told them Tai Chenji had been our guest. They think he came to save the world."
"I'm afraid they expect too much."
"They worship him. He's the son of Anak. His touch is pure magic. He can open the eyes of the blind, restore missing limbs, breathe new life into the dead."
Hake made a sardonic face. "They've never seen him do it."
"I'm sorry for you." Kenlith caught my hand. "I begged the agent. He says he can't do anything."
"Not that he gives a spit," Hake shrugged. "He's getting off his hot spot, transferring to a frontier station far upriver, next to the Free Tribes, waiting now for his replacement, and happy to have you out of his hair."
"They're taking you down the river," Kenlith said. "I don't know what they'll do with you there. I wish we could go with you."
He looked at his mother with silent appeal.
"I told you why we can't."
She shook her head, a shadow on her hollowed face.
"Paraclaw would be worse for us than the jungle."
The jailers rattled the bars, and they had to go. Hake advised me curtly to watch my step. Lilalu kissed my cheek. Kenlith gripped my hand with both of his and tried not to sob.
"I'm afraid, Tai Will." He swallowed hard and shook his head. "Afraid I'll never see you again."
So was I. I caught him to me and held him close till the jailer shouted for him to go. The new agent, a burly, blunt-spoken veteran of the River Patrol, arrived with a little detachment of native troops. He had me brought out of the cell to his office. Stripped of all those native artifacts, it was now severely bare, the desktop empty except for a sheaf of orders. He glanced at me and then at a slate clipboard. A chair stood empty in front of the desk, but he left me standing, facing his searching scowl. "You call yourself Willstone." "Tai Willstone?" He grinned as if the name amused him. "If you were really born a white Norlander, what are you doing with this black witch doctor?" "Ram Chenshi is my friend." "Ah, you've made the wrong friend." I tried to tell our story, but he was impatient with my halting language. "That's enough." He cut me off and beckoned the guard to take me out. "You're on your way to Paraclaw. You can try your tales on the High Commission." Yet the agent never sent me back to prison. Perhaps Hake's wife persuaded him to hear our story. Perhaps he wanted to look better in his reports to Paraclaw. Still, with no sign of belief, he had a sudden willingness to listen to our adventures on those other worlds beyond the Trilithon on Mount Anak. I was installed in a decent room and allowed to join his staff at decent meals. Bound upriver, the former agent was leaving his black mistress behind. I was on the dock when a packet docked to pick him up. Outraged and screaming at him, she thrust the squalling baby at his face. He stalked away. She followed, pleading. He shook her off. She drew a dirk and struggled with the guards until they dragged her and the baby away to the jail. Though the new agent had only a dozen men, he lined them up for inspection as if they had been a company and assured the refugees camped on the dock that they had nothing to fear from the rebels. "No organization," he told me. "No discipline. No leadership." He made a derisive shrug. "Your black friend, son of a god, or just another con artist, he is leading the fools to the slaughterhouse." Born in Paraclaw, son of a wealthy plantation owner, he had the same contempt for the Norlanders on the ruling High Commission. "White-bellied spiders, fat on the blood they suck out of us. Sky-high excise taxes on river trade, sky-high duties on every bale of cotton we ship north and every ounce of anything we have to buy. They're bleeding us dead." The High Commission acted at last. A gunboat arrived with supplies for the station and orders to rush me down the river. Half a dozen refugee families were waiting on the dock, hoping to escape with whatever they had been able to salvage from their abandoned homes, but the little boat had no space for them. The crew was tiny. The mulatto engineer and black fireman had double duty as gunners at the long cannon on the foredeck. The captain was white, a loud, angular man with a thick black mustache. Just out of military training, he was inflated with his new authority and proud to be white in a world of blacks. He had no time for me, no interest in my story. The pilot was a better companion, an affable little man who called himself Whitewater Kell. So dark I thought he had black blood. He listened to all I had to say about Earth and the Trilithons and liked to talk about the river and himself.
"Water's high," he told me. "Monsoon rains upstream."
The river ran fast where we were, a wide brown flood that lay flat from bank to tree-walled bank. Only a few hours out, we overtook a floating log. A human figure stood balanced on it, waving a broken branch. As we came near, I recognized Kenlith. I begged the pilot to pick him up. He was willing, but the captain balked.
"Let the beggar swim! We've got 10,000 like him waiting on the banks."
I kicked my sandals off as we passed by, dived off the rail and swam to the log. It was no act of heroism. The water was warm, and I'd spent my high school summers as a lifeguard at the municipal pool. Kenlith grinned, dropped his branch, and helped me climb on the log. The captain yelled lurid curses at me, words I hadn't learned, but he stopped the engine and launched a small boat to pick us up. Kenlith thanked me shyly and said he was starving. I got the cook to bring him a banana and a broiled fish leapt from breakfast. He devoured them and talked.
"A bad time," he said. "The raiders broke through the fence and got in the house. They took everything. The food off the table. My mother's books and pictures. My father's guns. I was afraid. I hid in the cellar. They burned the house over me. The air got hot and smoke got strong. I was caught there a long time, afraid the roof would fall in. It didn't, but I was still caught there in the dark, and I tried to get out when things got quiet, but something had fallen on the door. I couldn't get out till I found a tunnel that took me to the well. The raiders and my folks were gone when I climbed out. They never took the fort. The flag was still there, and I heard the cannon boom. But the new agent called me a mongrel pup when I begged him to help me. All I could do was follow the raiders and try to find my mother again. The raiders took a trail back into the forest where we used to go to look for nuts and fruit. I followed all day and the next with nothing to eat. I was afraid of snakes and crocodiles and jungle fevers, but I went on till I couldn't find the trail any farther. I was lost and hungry. All I could do was wander on and sleep at nights on the ground. Finally, I came to the river and water I could drink. That log came drifting past. I swam out and climbed on it. He caught my hand. I thank you, Ty Will. You saved my life. I gulped and put my arm around him. I've lost my mother and Ty Hake. Anxiously, he peered into my face. Please, can I stay with you? It took me a minute to answer. Something about him brought back dreams of my own that had faded long ago. My colleagues and my students had become my family. Lost here, desperate and alone, I was in no position to care for anybody. I had to get my breath. Okay, I told him, if you want to take your chances with me. He blinked at me through tears in his eyes. Thank you, Ty Will.
Chapter 18. Next morning we needed to refuel. Whitewater followed the channel markers to a pier built of unpeeled logs. The Norland flag flew from a pole over a rough wooden shelter. I saw stacks of firewood ready, but the place seemed abandoned. The men tied us up beside the pier and began pitching chunks of wood aboard. I heard a hail before they were done and saw a long dugout coming around the bend above us. The paddlers brought it near. I recognized Toron in the bow, pulling it closer. Ram stood behind him, waving a palm leaf. Will! He shouted. We heard you're on the way. We want to talk. The captain called his men to the cannon. He found a megaphone and shouted a command for the dugout to stand clear. Toron stabbed his pole into the mud to stop it where it was. He was nearly naked, yellow tiger stripes around his torso. Ram looked just as strange, in a black beret pulled down to his eyes, and a long robe dyed in a pattern of purple, green, and black. Yet he still carried the battered nylon backpack he had brought from home. He waved the palm leaf again. "Toron speaking for the rebels," he shouted. "They want to offer a truce."
"Black vermin," the captain snarled. "What sort of truce do they expect?"
Ram beckoned Toron to bring the dugout closer. The captain raised the megaphone.
"Keep away, or we'll blow you out of the water."
"I know him," I told the captain. "He's a friend of mine. We came here together from my own world. The rebels captured him. Listen to him, please." The captain shook his head with a skeptical scowl at me.
"Tell him I know the rebels," Ram shouted. "Toron's speaking for them. We want to talk to the High Commission if he'll grant us safe passage to Paraclaw." "Ha!" the captain sniffed. "I have no authority to offer safe passage to anybody."
"Maybe so," Whitewater said, "but let's hear them talk."
"Barter with those black apes. The High Commission would laugh."
"Maybe not," Whitewater insisted. "These men are risking their lives to talk. The intelligence service ought to be interested in what they have to say."
The captain scowled and let them tie up at the dock. Whitewater had the gangplank lowered. The engineer went down to search Ram and Toron for weapons. Ram laid down his jungle knife. Toron refused to leave his ancient blade. They left him on the dock, but Ram was allowed to climb aboard. He embraced me. "A long haul back to Portales. A lot has happened since I saw you." He offered his hand to the captain. "Good of you, sir. If you can take us down to Paraclaw." The captain ignored his hand and had Whitewater pat him down and search his pack for weapons. He swung to me.
"You say you know this man?"
"We came here together," I said, "through those old stone pillars on Mount Anak. You must have heard our story." The captain grunted and swung to Ram.
"What's your business with the High Commission?"
"Peace," Ram said.
"An offer of peace."
The captain bristled.
"We'll have peace when these jungle monkeys come to their senses."
Yet he huddled with Whitewater and led us into his cabin. We sat around a little table, the engineer ready with his gun behind us. Silently waiting, the captain glared at us.
"Believe me, sir," Ram begged him. "I know the rebels. They're fighting to take the river back and throw you whites off the continent. No real good for them. Disaster for Norlan. We want to offer something better."
The captain sniffed.
"Like what?" Whitewater asked. "If you care to hear it, sir."
The captain kept a stony face, and Ram turned to Whitewater.
"Toron's an envoy from the elders of the Korat Brotherhood.
Not a government exactly, but it's the organization behind the rebellion. He nodded at the captain. A force Barraclough ought to respect. They have the gunboats, but the elders have the jungle. Bluff enough, the captain muttered. What do they want? Respect, sir. Recognition of the Brotherhood as a sovereign nation. Liberation for its slave citizens. Fair pay for labor. Free trade on the river. Tax-free exports to Norlan. That's all they want? The captain scowled. What they get will be the hook through their ribs.
Listen, sir. The deal they want will be good for them, but better for Barraclough. They offer you peace, security for your colony on the Delta and your traffic on the river, untaxed export of the food and fuel you need in Norlan. Isn't that enough? The captain grunted scornfully. Look at the alternative, Ram urged him. I've met the native historians.
Historians? Black animals that can't read or write?
They're learning, Ram said. They're here underground. They study what they find in the ruins of the Lost Empire. I brought an artifact I think should help us persuade the High Commission. Would you like to see it, sir?
Jungle junk, the captain snorted. They peddle it to tourists.
Give them a chance, Whitewater urged. Intelligence might like to see it.
The captain shrugged and let Ram open his backpack. He dug out a thin little box like the one Derek found in the room where he slept on the planet of the robots. The captain shrank away as if it was a viper.
It doesn't bite, Ram turned to Whitewater.
I'm told that it came out of a sealed vault under a ruined temple of Sheko. The natives are terrified by a legend that she breathed death on the place. A white explorer dug it out. His porters stole it. Three of them died of a nasty jungle rot. The captain blinked uneasily, his hand near his gun.
I've heard the story.
Whitewater picked up the object, frowned at it, passed it back to Ram.
What is it?
Take a look.
Ram lifted the lid. A rainbow of colors lit an array of symbols. Sound pealed out of it, deep notes that throbbed to a rhythmic beat, lifted to a melancholy wail, and slowly died away. The symbols faded into darkness. Stars appeared in the silver dust of the Milky Way. Bright constellations swam across the screen. One star grew. A planet in orbit around it swelled to show seas and continents.
Africa, Ram whispered to me. They've been there.
I saw the shape of it, then a green plain edged with volcanic cones. It spread wide. I saw animals, wildebeest, antelope, ostriches, elephants. They raised their heads, froze, scattered in panic, from a rocket ship descending on a cushion of fire. The rocket dissolved into a tall, black trilithon. Strange machines crawled out of it, and then a file of dark-skinned men and women.
That's us, Ram said. A couple hundred thousand years ago, arriving from wherever we were born.
They vanished, and I saw a single human figure standing alone on a bare mountaintop, an aged black man, scarred and bent, leaning on a cane. He spoke in a strange, high voice, trilling syllables unlike anything I had ever heard. That uncanny music rolled again, and his voice gave way to a page of the symbols we had seen on the monuments of other worlds. Ram touched a key. The screen went black. He closed the box.
What's that? The captain muttered.
A book, Ram said and spoke to me. Maybe a computer if the ancients had computers. It seems to work like an e-book. The elders have recovered several of them. Nothing they can read, but the pictures are enough to reveal something about the Grand Dominion. That's their name for the Lost Empire. He turned back to the captain.
If you will grant us safe passage, we want to show this to Barraclough. I think it will help persuade the High Commission to talk.
They don't talk to such as you.
Sir, they should. The Grand Dominion is dead. Something killed it. I don't know what. Neither do the elders. But they have scholars working to recover its lost science.
Hot men scholars? They can't read or write.
But they're learning what they need to know.
Ram pushed the book across the table.
Paraclaw should give them a hearing. If you'll give us a safe conduct to that black bastard, I'd hang him first.
If you feel that way, Ram said, I'll go alone.
If you're that kind of fool, the captain shrugged and squinted at the box, just get that infernal machine out of my cabin.
Ram went down to huddle with Toron and his men before they climbed back into their dugout and pushed it away. Ram stood watching until it was gone beyond the bend. To pay my way, he took off his robe to sweat with the crew, loading the rest of the firewood. When that was done, we steamed down again down the mud-colored blood. He shared the cabin with Kenlith and me. I wanted to hear about where he had been, but he was slow to talk.
Later, he said and shook his head. I've learned a lot since I saw you. More of the language and things you'd never believe.
He stood silent for a time, gazing into the jungle behind us.
Too much has happened to me. I need Lupe to help me decide what I am.
He slept most of the afternoon and woke with a haunted face.
What a dream.
He grimaced and blinked at me. At first I thought we were back at home at one of our poker nights. Lupe was about to serve her guacamole salad, but then she was little mama, reading the script in that artifact. It was a message from Derek and Lupe. They were lost in a stranger world and this, hiding from the hoppers. And then...
His shoulders hunched uneasily. It's all too much. Too much that gets me down.
He sat rubbing his eyes as if still half asleep.
I learned my science from Derek and Lupe. It's meant to make life simple. Nice, clean answers to everything. But my life, was never that simple.
We anchored before sunset in the shallows off a sandbar, where we were out of the current. The engineer dropped a hook over the rail and pulled up a magnificent silver-colored fish that he grilled for dinner. The fireman found ripe papayas in a field on the bank. I recall that meal as an unexpected moment of pleasure. The fish and fruit were excellent. The captain sat watching Ram with silent suspicion, but Whitewater opened a bottle of very good wine to play the jovial host. Ram laughed at his tall tales of life on the river as if all his problems had been forgotten. Night had fallen before we got back to the cabin. While I was fumbling in the dark for a match to light a candle, Ram closed the door and took off his cap. Light filled the room. When he looked at me, I saw that it came from his birthmark, shining like something incandescent. Chapter 19. The anchored ship was soundless that night, except for the muffled thump of the watchman's boots on the deck and the far-off howl of some jungle thing we never saw. The room was dark. When he lifted his wrist to read his watch, it was lit by a glow of light from the birthmark on his forehead.
The crown of worlds. I had to sit down on my berth, blinking in startled awe. Did it ever shine before?
Never.
The mark shone brighter when he raised his head to look at me, but he said no more until I asked,
You say things have happened to you? A long story.
He paused, and his voice had fallen when he spoke again.
Things I don't understand. I almost hate to tell you. I don't want to make a stranger of you.
No danger. Just tell me.
I'll try. He nodded soberly. If you won't call me crazy.
Lying on his berth, he began to talk.
I've been initiated into the Korath Brotherhood.
The birthmark cast its faint and eerie glow on the ceiling of the hot and silent cabin. He spoke deliberately as if reliving the story he told.
It was Toron who got me out of Hake's compound. He'd seen the mark, of course, but he took it for a tattoo. Took me for one more ambitious pretender to the legacy of Anak. It wasn't shining then, but he thought he could use me as a figurehead leader for the revolt. I've lived a sort of epic in the jungle since.
The steamy breath of the jungle came through the window, a thin, sharp scent of strange blooms and strange decay. I felt grateful for its cool feel on my naked skin. Kenlith lay snoring softly on the floor.
The whites dread the jungle, but it's a loving mother to the hot men. It feeds them, shelters them, hides them from the slavers. Derek and Lopi would give their skins for a chance to learn Hotland culture and their history. I've tried to pick up what I could. Hotland's huge, bigger than Africa. Hake's wife showed me a map. It sprawls across the tropics. The coasts have been well explored in the navigable channels of Blood River. The mountain chain on the west coast is higher than the Himalayas. There's a second Sahara across the north, and a vast stretch of the south still blank on the map. The Blood drains half the continent, most of its jungle still unexplored by the whites, but home to the natives. Hundreds, maybe thousands of tribes. You'd call them savages. No writing, no printing, no metals except scraps they salvage. They've got no government, no cities, and no common language. Yet they're children of the civilization that opened the gates and got them here. How they lost it is the sort of riddle that Lupi loves to solve. She'd find clues everywhere, beginning with the Korath Elderhood. They worship the little they remember and dream of restoring the great past they've lost. That's what Toron's fighting for, his chance to beat the Norlanders and liberate the slaves. The natives are nomads, following the creatures they hunt over the seasons when food plants are ripening. But Toron took me to a permanent center. A strange experience.
Kenlith cried out in his sleep. Ram sat up to look. In the glow of the birthmark, I saw the boy twist and beat at the air for a moment until he relaxed and lay back with his head in his arm, a slight smile on his lips. I was growing fond of him and worried about his future, half black and half white in this world of bitter race division. Outside, a long-drawn wail quavered and died. Something answered from farther away. Ram must have seen me shrink.
Unearthly, the mark lit his grin. This isn't Earth, but it helps to believe that all of its life originated there. That seems strange, but Derek thought so. The animals and plants we've seen, most of them are more or less familiar. Derek thought the differences must be due to streams of evolution over maybe 100,000 years. A lot of it here has become hard to recognize. I've seen things that I hope never lived on Earth. One of them...
He frowned and shook his head, staring into the dark beyond the open window. Far across the Black River, something shrieked and shrieked again. His grin was gone. He rubbed at the shining mark as if it hurt or somehow troubled him.
I'd set out with Toron on a trek to the site for my initiation. A man I wanted to like. I admired him for his courage and his stoicism in the face of pain. He seemed dedicated to the liberation and future of his people. But I knew that he had been a slaver. He was generous and helpful to me, yet I knew he saw me as a tool that might serve his own grand plans. We went north from the Blood in a dugout with half a dozen warriors at the paddles. One carried a captured army rifle. The others had two or three handguns or native weapons. For long days we rode or pulled up tributaries that narrowed into gloomy green tunnels and ended finally at the foot of a rocky escarpment where we had to leave the boat. We climbed that to a trail choked with undergrowth so thick that only Toron could follow it. Back at home I had an excellent sense of direction, a sort of compass in my head. But on this planet... He frowned again and shook his head, the glow of the birthmark dancing over the walls. Here, it's gone. I felt lost without it, lost and helpless. The trail was hard to follow, but Toron knew his way. The going became difficult, a tangle of vines as thick as ropes, undergrowth so dense we had to slash our way with jungle knives. We waded rivers and slogged through swamps. There were trees and creatures I knew, but more I didn't. One day I caught a scent. He seemed to shudder, the light of the birthmark flickering over the room. It turned me sick. A heavy, fetid sweetness that had a carrion taint. Toron held his nose and pointed off the trail. Slubro, slubrak, he said. That translates as gutworm, though it was a plant. He said Sheko's angel of death had breathed on the seed. She had sowed them to guard her tomb and annex, which stood ahead of us at the end of the trail. I wanted to see it. Toron wasn't eager. He said he'd been there as a guide for a Norlander named Carno Fenn, who was a friend of the natives. He'd made a fortune with a ship line and a chain of trading posts on the river and spent most of it building schools and hospitals for us. He wanted to join the Elderhood, and the Elders agreed to honor him with an initiation. Toron warned him of ugly spots in a jungle, places still contaminated, I imagine, with lethal agents left from that ancient Armageddon. He was older than you are, Toron said, but still vigorous enough. When he heard about the Slubro Slubrak, he had to have a photo for his journal of the expedition. A madman, as Toron tells the story. He had a breathing mask that let him stand the odor. He bribed Toron to go on with him. The jungle thinned. There came to a stand of dwarfed and twisted plants, into a clearing where the rocky ground was littered with the bones of things that had died there. Toron kept away from the Slubro Slubrak, but Fenn took pictures, and Toron got back with his camera. An ugly thing, he said. Its leaves were huge and black, thick as mattresses, scattered with long yellow spines. They lay flat for yards on the rocky ground. A single, enormous bloom, purple and trumpet-shaped, crowned a central stalk. Fenn's mask didn't save him. Toron saw him stagger and tried to call him back, but he went closer for another picture. Toron heard a pop. Something sailed out of the bloom and fell near Fenn. A seed, Toron said. He has Fenn's picture. It's purple-black, about the size of a plum. Toron was sick with the stink of it. Fenn was drunk on it or somehow overcome. Toron says he picked it up, sniffed it, bit into it for a taste, swallowed it whole, and staggered back to Toron. He soon seemed to be himself again. Toron found the trail again, and they went on. The next day he complained of an ache in his gut. That grew worse. He lost strength until he had to be carried on a stretcher. The pain was so severe he begged Toron to kill him. On the last night he crawled away from the tent to relieve himself and never come back. Toron searched for him when day came and finally found what was left. Ram stopped and looked at me with an expression the like of which I had never seen. I thought the birthmark had dimmed. Far off across the river I heard a long-drawn wail that might have been Fenn's ghost. A breath of air from the window seemed to have a taint of death. "I don't know," he muttered at last. Derek was convinced that all the life here came from Ert. I know evolutionary jumps are facilitated by small gene pools and changed on survival, but Toron showed me the shots he salvaged from Fenn's camera. It's hard to believe that thing can exist. The Slubro Slubrak. He paused again and shook his head. All Toron found was Fenn's empty skin. The film shows it lying flat in a puddle of bloody excrement. The flesh is gone. The bones. The skull. Toron says he stood there a long time staring at it, till he thought to keep a record and reach for the camera. The moment he moved, he heard an uncanny sound. A shrill cackle, he says, like nothing he ever heard before, but somehow like a human laugh. It came out of the stunted stuff around the clearing. He looked and saw the snake. A monstrous thing, he says, the sleek black coils of it half hidden in the undergrowth, its lifted head as tall as a man. The head was shaped like Fenn's skull. Ram shook his head at me, and the glow of the birthmark dimmed. Toron showed me the film and tried to describe the head. He says it stared at him for a minute or two. Its eyes were huge. They never blinked. Fenn had worn glasses. Toron swears those eyes were shaped like the lenses. He was trying to steady his hand for another shot when it cackled again and slithered out of sight.
Chapter 20
De Slubro Slubrok. Ram sat staring at me, shaking his head, the light of the birthmark flickering across the wall. If the old ones were genetic engineers, they created a nightmare. Maybe the god forbidden spots. I wish I'd never seen it. He shrugged and raised his hand to hide the light as the watchman's boots came thumping by. The tiny cabin was hushed except for the murmur of the current against the hull, and sometimes the cry of some far-off jungle thing.
It's another world, he muttered as the boots receded. Kin to ours, I know, but still we don't belong. I don't think we ever will, even if we're stuck here till we die. And I think we are.
Maybe not, I tried to cheer him. If we ever find Derek and Lupe, don't count on it. His voice was short. I don't expect them, he caught himself. But we can't let it get us down. His grim face relaxed and the crown lit an easy-seeming grin. Here we are. Maybe in little Mama's hell. Maybe at the gate to her heaven if she had a heaven. We got to make the best of any breaks we get.
About the Korath Brotherhood, I prompted him. And your initiation?
His voice grew more sober. Toron warned me that Sheko had laid her curse on the land ahead, but I let him lead us on. The lush jungle stuff gave way to a harsher sort of country. The trails spread wider, winding through gnarled and stunted trees. Sometimes it followed a scrap of ancient pavement. We passed a tall black granite stele. The inscriptions eroded away and crossed a deep ravine on a dry viaduct that once carried water to a field of stony mounds that had been a city once.
Relics of the Grand Dominion, Toron said. It was a rich and happy land, he said, until the sad day that Sheko found Anak with a human woman. In her rage, she tore stars from the sky to hurl at them and breathed death on him and all the women he had dared to love. Yet that vengeance gave her no joy. Mad with grief for the love she had lost, she rebuilt the stones of his palace into a tomb for him and sowed the seed of the Slubra Slubrok to guard it from his bastard half-human sons. When that was done, she built her own tomb and lay in it to die a sorrow. Ram made a quizzical face. Toran's story. Sheer nonsense to me. Lupe says such legends have nearly always grown out of some actual event. But it's hard to imagine any kernel of truth. He stopped to listen to a faint and distant banshee wail. Sometimes I wonder about Sheko and her breath of death. As we went on, we kept on stumbling on signs of some blight I never understood. The blasted vegetation gave way to stark desolation, and the sun seemed hotter. A few high clouds gave no rain. We sweated on across naked rock and dunes of drifted dust. Death's dark domain. He gave me a wry little grin. That was my pet phrase for it. A dead gray waste. No life anywhere. It got to me. Dead stone. Dead sand. Dead silence. No bird sang. Nothing moved. Not even a lizard. He left me wondering what killed the Grand Dominion. We, ourselves, were close to death. But Toron tramped on till I thought he was mad. My feet were blistered. Our food was gone, the last water canteen half empty. I thought we ought to turn back and ask Toron if we had gone too far for that.
No go back. He was learning English. We get there. I asked him where. Place of life, he said. Place of wisdom. Cave of elders.
Next day, Ram continued, we saw a dark streak across the bleak horizon ahead, and then a faint green line below it.
It rose as we neared it, a long escarpment of red sandstone. Next morning we reached another aqueduct. Half ruined, it still carried a thin stream of water from a spring at the foot of a cliff. Water. We'd been desperate for it. Toron and his men knelt to kiss the ground and give thanks to Anak. We buried our faces in the stream to drink, splashed each other to wash off all the sweat and grime. Following the aqueduct, we came to a field of growing corn, and then a row of ripe yellow melons, as sweet as cantaloupes. Heaven, he shrugged and laughed at himself. I thought we'd crossed little Mama's hell and reached her heaven. We stuffed ourselves with those melons and tramped on into that small paradise. I heard what sounded like a mockingbird singing. A man shouted at us from a mango tree. Ram called to him, and he climbed down and came to meet us. An angel, I thought, in little Mama's heaven. Or at least a saint. It's a tall black man in a neat green tunic and turban. His flowing beard was white with age, though he seemed spry as I was, carrying his basket of ripe mangoes. They embraced, greeting each other in a language new to me. Olek An, Toron said. Voice of elders. He shared his mangoes and guided us along the cliffs to an overhang that sheltered the mouth of a limestone cave. He hammered a gong that brought a dozen men out of the fields in a cave. Elders, Toron said. Leaders of elderhood. They were an odd little group. All of them black. Aged but fit. All of them uniformed in the green tunic and turban. They surrounded us, staring at me, calling questions to Toron in that tongue I'd never heard. We were still famished. At last, when the questions were answered, they set out a feast, dried meat, dried fruit, and hard dry bread. As we ate, I had questions of my own for Toron. He was slow to answer. Place of secrets, he said. Secrets kill you. Well, the elders do have secrets that I have sworn to guard, but there are things I am free to say. The elderhood is not a government. The blacks are scattered in hundreds of isolated nomadic bands. They want no government. The council of the elders is a little like a college, a little like a monastery, a little like a congress, but without visible power. It has only 13 members, elected from 13 secret cells scattered through the jungle. The elders think of themselves as the last surviving vestige of the Grand Dominion, and they've been trying to find and preserve relics of it, hoping for some kind of restoration and recovery. Toron sees a new promise in our arrival. There's the legend of a half-god, marked with the Crown of Worlds, returning through the Gate of Anak to restore the Grand Dominion. Toron saw us appear there. He's seen the mark. He wants to believe. Yet he's a realist, a doubter of miracles. There have been known con men tattooed with the crown who proclaimed their own grand schemes. He first took me for another, but that didn't matter. He hoped to use me as a symbol to energize the slave rebellion. He took me to see the archives of the elderhood and relics of the lost empire stored at the back of the cave. The elders have no real right in the system. But he showed me sheaves of little bamboo splints strung on cords and notched along the edges to record names and dates and facts. He showed me a shelf of e-books like the one he gave me and a chest made of something still as bright as stainless steel. It was lined with gold and filled with little crystal rods, magic sticks, he called them. Their